This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So the significance of this new railway is that it's the country's largest infrastructure project since independence. It cost approximately $3.3 billion, and the plan is to actually link it from Mombasa to Uganda and then potentially beyond to Rwanda.
That's VOA East Africa correspondent Jill Craig in Nairobi describing Kenya's new express rail line. The full story coming up.
Also, two UN agencies have unveiled plans to expand humanitarian operations in Libya. Meanwhile, Egyptian warplanes launched airstrikes on several training camps in the Libyan port city of Derna.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Kenya's new railway line opened today. The train, dubbed the Matakara Express, made its maiden journey from a gleaming new terminal in Mombasa to Nairobi. On board were President Uhuru Kenyatta, Chinese dignitaries, and citizens from around the country. President Kenyatta hailed the new rail as one of the key cornerstones to Kenya's transformation to an industrialized, prosperous, middle-income country. However, not everyone agrees the Chinese-funded train line will boost Kenya's economy to that point, given its high cost. VOA East Africa correspondent Jill Craig spoke with me about the significance of the new train line. She also touched on what some skeptics have to say about the major project.
So the significance of this new railway is that it's the country's largest infrastructure project since independence. It cost approximately $3.3 billion, and the plan is to actually link it from Mombasa to Uganda and then potentially beyond to Rwanda. This really represents quite a shift in, I guess, policy, you could say, for Kenya's leadership. President Kenyatta has put quite a large emphasis upon infrastructure projects in Kenya, and we've seen this a few times before. He's also prioritized roads, pipelines, oil development, even geothermal power. This is definitely on the Kenyatta government's priorities list.
Now, this was a collaboration with the Chinese, and I understand it was done through a loan that Kenya will have to pay back. So how is that going to work out?
The plan, as I understand it, is that the Chinese government, first of all, they funded about 90% of the railway project through the government-owned Export-Import Bank of China, and Kenya's government provided, I think, about 10% of the overall cost. This is a massive project. Something worth mentioning is that the cost represents about 5% of Kenya's overall GDP. That has also drawn some criticism from skeptics who say you spent way too much on this project, and we don't know for sure that the outcome is going to pay for what we put into it. Others, more optimistically, say that they believe that this is really going to help Kenya's economy. It's going to boost the economy of East Africa, and that overall it's going to help people, sort of the ordinary Kenyans. It will actually help them in the long run.
Were any local Kenyans used in building the rail system?
Yes, and in the beginning that was quite a controversy because people did not think that they would be used, but the China Road and Bridge Company did employ about 20,000 local workers. So that sort of appeased some people, I should say. Another issue that has been brought up several times throughout this building process is that people are concerned about the wildlife. Kenya is known for its wildlife. The concern was that the new railway would disrupt migration patterns and whatnot in the area that the railway would go through. But the Chinese did make some concessions. They did allow for underpasses to be built for wildlife to cross, I know, at least the section of a railway near Tsavo National Park. But again, that doesn't mean that everyone's happy.
I understand this particular train is the express from Mombasa to Nairobi. So is it something that people will be able to afford to travel back and forth?
Yes, that's the plan. In the old days, it would cost approximately $12 for someone to take the bus from Nairobi to Mombasa and vice versa. The Kenyatta government today announced that it will cost Kenyans about the equivalent of $7 to travel between Nairobi and Mombasa. It makes it more affordable. Another big draw is that the time that it will take to actually travel between the two cities will be significantly reduced. So currently, taking the two-lane highway that goes between Nairobi and Mombasa, it takes about, if you're lucky, around 10 hours, but it could be even longer than that by bus. Now the plan is that trip will take about 4 hours. For Kenyans, it represents quite a difference in both price and also in time spent in transport.
Considering the upcoming election in August, what is the significance of the timing of this new system?
The timing of this railway launch has been debated quite heavily on social media, in the newspapers, and that's because the elections are coming up on August 8th, and this railway was not supposed to be launched until December of this year. So it was actually delivered several months ahead of schedule, and people believe that there is significance in this, given that the Kenyatta government and his ruling Jubilee Party want to sort of showcase what they've done to the country in advance of the upcoming elections. It should be mentioned that the opposition's candidate for president, Mr. Raila Odinga, has said that although he's not against these sorts of massive infrastructure projects, should his party become the ruling party come August, he will plan on spending more of his effort in helping Kenyans access basic needs, such as health care, education, you know, livelihood, helping the youth with getting jobs. So he's going to focus more on those sorts of policies versus these massive infrastructure projects.
That was VOA's East Africa correspondent, Jill Craig. She spoke with me from Nairobi.
Two UN agencies have unveiled plans to expand humanitarian operations in Libya to help migrants, refugees, asylum seekers, and those affected by conflict. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, and the International Organization for Migration say more international action is needed to help ensure basic human rights and protections. The UNHCR has appealed for an extra $75.5 million, while the IOM wants to expand its three-year action plan for Libya to aid displaced Libyans and migrants and stabilize communities.
Egyptian warplanes launched airstrikes on several training camps in the Libyan port city of Derna. The move was in retaliation for an attack on Coptic Christians in Egypt, in which at least 29 people were killed. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi linked the camps in Libya to the Egyptian affiliate of the Islamic State group. Ambassador Alberto Fernandez is a former coordinator for strategic counterterrorism communications at the U.S. State Department. Mohammed El-Shanawi asked him about that linkage, since Derna fighters are known to be the ones that drove ISIS from the Libyan coast.
As far as we know, that's right. I mean, obviously, there are ISIS fighters in Libya, and it's very likely they could have hit them in other places. But Derna is not a place where you have ISIS fighters. Maybe in other parts, internal in the desert, you would find ISIS training camps or ISIS groups of fighters.
And was targeting Libya a hasty decision?
I don't think it was. I think Egypt has equities and Egypt has reasons for its actions in Libya. What they clearly did is to, as we say in English, kill two birds with one stone, to take advantage of the need to react to this terrible terrorist attack and also realize that they had things that they wanted to do in Libya. Obviously, it's not a clear-cut connection between the two, but governments often do that. Governments often take an opportunity to deal with issues that have to do with something else.
Some members of the Libyan parliament called on the Libyan Presidential Council to file a complaint at the UN Security Council against Egypt for raiding Libyan targets without coordination with the government of national accord and without proof of any Libyan involvement in the Copts massacre. Would that work?
Well, I think, you know, the problem there is that Libya actually has no working government. It has contending governments, and it's an unsettled, near-anarchic situation. So those statements are interesting within the context of Libya, but they don't have much effect outside of its borders.
Addressing U.S. President Donald Trump, President Sisi said, "You have said that your priority is to confront terrorism, and I trust you are capable of doing that." In a statement released in Washington, President Trump said, "Terrorists are engaged in a war against civilization, and it's up to all who value life to confront and defeat this evil." What do you make of that?
I think he's absolutely right. What the president is saying is the focus and should be the focus of all people of goodwill from any religion and any worldview to destroy this evil. The challenge is that the problem goes beyond the people who are actually carrying out terrorist acts. There's a whole environment which helps extremism grow, which, you know, includes political, social, economic, and religious aspects that contribute to the rise of jihadism.
So what should Egypt's strategy look like to prevent this terrorist group from targeting Christian Copts as a vulnerable minority in Egypt?
Well, obviously, you need better implementation of your security steps. For example, a convoy of believers going to a shrine in the desert should have had protection. But beyond that, it needs to address the kind of the ideological political challenge of the extremists as well. And that's a much slower, more complicated process. So you have to do both. You have to work on the security angle, be more effective and more aggressive in that space. But then you need to address this whole basket of other things, political, economic, social, religious, that also play into the creation of Salafi jihadist worldview and violence.
That was reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi. He was speaking with Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, a former coordinator for strategic communications at the U.S. State Department.
The World Health Organization says even though the DRC government has approved the use of an experimental Ebola vaccine, it does not mean the vaccine will be administered in remote northern Bazwell province. A spokesman says there have been no new cases of Ebola reported in the region since earlier this month. He says unless new cases are reported, it's not likely the experimental vaccine from Merck would be used. There are currently only 14 suspected cases and 4 confirmed deaths. Health officials are monitoring about 100 people who may have come in contact with an infected person. The WHO spokesman says it would be very expensive to conduct an Ebola vaccine campaign in northern DRC because it is so remote and because the vaccine must be stored at minus 80 degrees Celsius.
University of Pittsburgh scientists have developed a new test that could lead to drugs that rid the body of HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Current antiretroviral drug treatment can lower the amount of virus in the blood to undetectable levels. Despite that, some HIV hides and lies dormant, ready to replicate if treatment is ever stopped. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Treatment for HIV infection has come a long way. At one time, patients had to take 30 or more pills a day with terrible side effects. Now they may take just one a day. But while antiretroviral drugs can allow patients to live near normal lives, it's still not a cure. HIV hides in CD4 immune cells, lymph nodes, rectal tissue, the brain, and other areas. Very expensive tests that can take up to 2 weeks to get results are able to detect latent HIV in the body, but not how much or what percentage can actually reignite infection if given the chance. Now, scientists at the University of Pittsburgh have developed a faster, cheaper, easier, and more sensitive test for HIV. It's called TZA. It detects an HIV gene that is turned on when a replicating virus is present. The findings appear in the journal Nature Medicine. Dr. Falguni Gupta is the senior author. He explains why antiretroviral drugs don't kill dormant HIV.
They go into these CD4 cells and they don't do anything. They do not express the protein. They do not express the virus. The body has no way to know this virus is present there. It's like a thief is hiding inside a house. You cannot see it. You cannot catch it, you cannot kill it. The drug only will be able to take care of it if the virus comes out. If they don't do anything, sit there, the drug does not work.
What's more, it shows the amount of dormant HIV in people who've been on treatment to be 70 times larger than previously thought. Gupta says new drugs are needed that target dormant HIV and activate it so it can be detected and treated. The new TZA test could determine how successful treatment is by measuring the amount of HIV that remains, if any.
A series of drugs are being tested, and we are also testing, that can unlock those things that we're keeping the virus on check so the virus can come out. And then once it comes out, then the existing retroviral drugs or the immune cells can kill it. So they call shock and kill strategy. You shock the virus so they come out and then kill it.
It's not known when those drugs might be on the market. Gupta says two are in clinical trial, but early results are not very promising. There are two or three others in development. If they can be made to work, Gupta says a cocktail of several of those drugs may be needed to shock the dormant HIV so it can be killed. And if the TZA test shows all the HIV is gone, then maybe, just maybe, the word cure could be used. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Computer algorithms power much of modern life, from our Facebook feeds to international stock exchanges. Could they help end malnutrition and hunger in Africa? The International Center for Tropical Agriculture thinks so. Lenny Ruvaga has the story from Nairobi.
The International Center for Tropical Agriculture has spent the past 4 years developing the Nutrition Early Warning System, or NEWS. The goal is to catch the subtle signs of a hunger crisis brewing in Africa as much as a year in advance. SIAT says the system uses machine learning. As more information is fed into the system, the algorithms will get better at identifying patterns and trends. The system will get smarter. Information technology expert Andy Jarvis leads the project.
The cutting edge side of this is really about bringing in streams of information from multiple sources and making sense of it. But it's a huge volume of information, and the novelty is then you making sense of that using things like artificial intelligence, machine learning, and condensing it into simple messages.
Other nutrition surveillance systems exist, like FuseNet, the Famine Early Warning System Network, which was created in the mid-1980s. But SIAT says NEWS will be able to draw insight from a massive amount of diverse data, enabling it to identify hunger risks faster than traditional methods. Dr. Marcy Lungaho is a SIAT nutrition expert.
What is different about NEWS is that it pays attention to malnutrition, not just drought or famine, but the nutrition outcome that really matters, malnutrition, especially in women and children. For the first time, we're saying these are the options, way ahead of time, that gives policymakers an opportunity to really do what they intend to do, which is make the lives of women and children better in Africa.
While food emergencies like famine and drought grab headlines, the International Center for Tropical Agriculture says chronic malnutrition affects 1 in 4 people in Africa, taking a serious toll on economic growth and leaving them especially vulnerable in times of crisis. Senior Policy Officer Olufunso Somerin is with the Africa Development Bank.
In 2030, 13 years from now, Africa is going to have 200 million children below the age of 5. Now, once a child is stunted or misses a level of nourishment at that age, it affects that child psychologically, economically, socially. So a stunted child in future is actually a stunted economy. So linking issues of nutrition at individual level to Africa's development and transformation on a broader scale is important.
SIAT says African governments will be able to access NEWS via nutrition dashboards, where they can get risk assessments, alerts, and recommendations. The system is expected to become operational in 4 African countries, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Somalia, and Nigeria, by year's end. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
24 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. New York City officials say nearly 4 out of 10 New Yorkers were born abroad, and nearly half of the city's residents speak languages other than English at home. Most are immigrants who cannot read or understand the mainstream media. To fill the gap, many get news about their communities from New York's vibrant ethnic and community press. VOA's Adam Phillips attended the IPPIS Awards ceremony, celebrating the diversity, power, and reach of these smaller media outlets.
at the City University of New York Center for Community and Ethnic Media. Festive ethnic dress and multilingual chatter resembled a kind of homespun United Nations. But these weren't diplomats and attachés eating the shrimp, empanadas, and curry hors d'oeuvres. They were reporters, editors, publishers, and presenters from over 300 of New York's print, broadcast, and online media outlets. They came to the IPPIs Awards Gala to celebrate the best of their colleagues' work over the past year. Jahangir Khatek is one of the IPPIs' principal organizers.
We feel that this media must be recognized. This media's work must be shared with wider audiences. We feel that the more we report, we will create more civic engagement, and that brings in more educated citizenry, more responsible citizenry, brings prosperity, and also it helps integrate communities into the mainstream.
Building bridges between the ethnic and the mainstream media is why Gambia-born Sheikh Musa Drama, publisher of the Muslim Community Report, attends this celebration year after year.
Unfortunately, you know, the African community has always been underreported or underrepresented by the media, mainstream media. And the Muslim community, unfortunately, has always been misrepresented. So what we're trying to do now is create a conduit between the mainstream to these two communities and from these two communities to the mainstream.
Reporter Rong Zhangqing of the Tsingtao Daily, one of the world's most widely read Chinese newspapers, won an IPPI for her story about survivors of the Golden Venture cargo boat. It ran aground in 1993 in Queens, New York, with 283 undocumented immigrants. Many of them panicked and died in the cold waters. 24 years later, Xiao Qing found that many who had been allowed to settle here are living happy and productive lives.
That's part of the reason that why did I want to do the story, because I really want to show people what immigrants really mean to this country. The people I interviewed, they worked so hard here, and they never made any trouble. They're not criminals, they're not rapists. They worked hard and saved money little by little, and in this country, they participated in politics, they vote.
When ethnic communities learn through the press what politicians are doing to help or hinder their interests, it helps them hold those public figures to account at the ballot box. The ethnic media also enables policymakers to communicate with New York's non-English-speaking communities. The IPPIs also honor media outlets that serve communities with mixed ethnic groups. David Cruz of the Norwood News won an IPPI for reporting on noise pollution in a Bronx district that is home to thousands of Central Americans and Bangladeshis.
It's too loud. People are really blasting the radio. They're blasting the ice cream trucks, the police noise, airplane noise. I mean, people complain virtually about everything about that. And a lot of it comes down to people think that the city's not paying attention.
Another story that deserved an IPPI this year included a piece about the tension within traditionally ethnic neighborhoods when outsiders move in and rents are raised above reach. There was investigative reporting about alleged police brutality in a predominantly Arab neighborhood, and a feature story about how Russian-speaking gays are getting a new start in Brooklyn, and there were many other stories to tell. But if one message underlies all these stories, it's this: New Yorkers of every origin matter and must be seen to matter far beyond the ethnic and community enclaves they call home. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And that's it for African News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a look at the life and journey of Mzee Boniface Byanyima, arguably one of Africa's most unique and remarkable teachers. The political icon died on May 16th at age 97. A discussion on Uganda's political giant. That's right here on Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.